Parsha Toldos primarily focuses on the power struggle or divergence between Yaakov and Esav, and it's built up largely over a four-episode sort of story arc that begins before the twins are even born. So before they're born, when they're in Rivka's stomach, Rivka feels that the children are struggling within her, and she goes to seek the word from Hashem, to seek insight in terms of what in the world is happening with this child that she's pregnant with. Of course, she finds out that it's not one, but two children, and they're going to be very different children who are going to produce two different nations, and eventually, ultimately, the elder is going to serve the younger. So Rivka has insight into the future paths of her sons, but that doesn't mean that anybody else does. So we skip to the next episode, which is when Rivka gives birth to these children, and we are told that Esav comes out hairy and red. So already the Torah is giving us some hint from day one as to the identity or at least the inclinations of Esav. And Yaakov, on the other hand, we do not so much see anything about him, which helps define him for us. The only thing we see about him is not really about his personality, his identity, as much as perhaps his inclinations or aspirations, because he's born holding on to Esav's Akev, right? So he's named Yaakov. He's holding on to this heel of Esav. And so he is already trying to get beyond where he is and perhaps even struggle to be first. Okay, so now we're going to skip ahead. Of course, the next episode is where we get to the point that Yaakov already claims the Bechorah, the firstborn status, when with the soup episode where Esav sells it to him. So what's really interesting is you have this key story where Yaakov becomes firstborn after he buys the right for the pot of soup, and Esav gives it away. So it should be all neat and tied and done. But then what you would expect to see in episode number four is that now that Yaakov has bought the Bechorah and he's got his contract, he's got his deed, you would think that when it comes time 25 years later for Yitzchak to give his firstborn the Bracha, Yaakov should be like, yeah, Abba, that's me. Remember, I'm your firstborn. I showed you that contract. If not, I'll whip it out right now. I'm happy to show you. That's me. Bracha comes to me. I'm your firstborn. It goes to me. There should not be any need for Yaakov to come and trick Yitzchak, because Yitzchak should already be in the loop. There should not be any question about who the bracha should go to. There should not be any need for Rivka to convince Yaakov that that's his bracha. And by the way, there shouldn't be any reason that Esav would expect that that should be his bracha. He should say, no, Daddy, I remember when I was 15 and I sold my firstborn rights to Yaakov, so that goes to him. Remember? I was happy with that. He was happy with that. So we sold that. So yeah, he gets that bracha, but I'm happy to take a different bracha for like the younger brother, whatever. That would go to me. But it doesn't unfold this way. Instead, we had one story already where Yaakov takes place as the firstborn when he buys the rights for soup. And then we have a follow-up story taking place 25 years later when they are 40, where it feels like all over again, Yaakov's making a play to gain firstborn rights. But didn't he have that already? Why didn't he claim it? Why doesn't Yitzchak know that Yaakov is now his firstborn? Why hasn't he known that for 25 years? It's very mysterious why there's two separate stories about Yaakov rising to his rightful place as firstborn status. Okay, so it could be that a little bit of the hint as to why this is going on can be found in the episode of the sale itself, right? The earlier episode number three. Okay, so if you look in Bereishis Chaf Hey, Pasuk Chaf Zion, it says like follows. The lads grew. Esav was a hunter. He's a man of the field. Whereas Yaakov was an ish tam, Yoshev Ohalim. He's a simple man, a man in the tents. Okay. Ve'yehav Yitzchak et Esav ketzai b'fiv. And Yitzchak loved Esav because Esav's hunting food was in his mouth. Ve'rivka ohevet et Yaakov. And Rivka loves Yaakov. Ve'yizid Yaakov nazid. So Yaakov is cooking this lentil soup. Ve'yavo Esav min hasadeh v'hu ayif. And Esav comes from the field, and he is tired. Vayomer Esav al Yaakov. So Esav says to Yaakov, "Haliteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. Give me, please, some of this red stuff. Pour it right in. Ki ayef anochi, because I'm so tired." Alkin kirashmo Edom, and that's why, by the way, his name is ultimately called Edom. So we have a question right here. It's saying he came from the field, and wow, is Esav tired. So if he comes in and he's super tired, what do you expect him to be searching for? If I come home and I'm exhausted from a day at work, I might sprawl out on the couch. I might plop down on my bed because if I'm tired, I need a nap. It's not I'm tired, so give me some of that food, give me some of that drink, give me some of that red stuff. It should be maybe I'm hungry, so give me some of that food. I'm thirsty, give me some of that drink. Right? Why is he saying, "I'm so exhausted"? Pour that stuff in. Pour that stuff in. So it's strange. This is a weird lashon to start with. Okay, so Yaakov hears this. Vayomer Yaakov, and Yaakov says, "Michrocha yom es bechorascha li. I want you to sell your firstbornship to me," which is really weird. If my sibling is hungry, I don't ask for their firstborn rights. Right? That doesn't seem to follow. But okay. And wait. Lo and behold, I guess Yaakov knew something because Esav says, okay. But Yom Esav says, "Hine anochi halech lamus. You know what? I'm going to die. V'lamazel li b'chora. So what do I need a b'chora for?" Very strange logic. I don't know why he's going to die. I don't know what that has to do with selling his b'chora. But Yom Yaakov, and Yaakov says, "Yishavali. I want you to swear to me kayom today, or as clear as day, v'shavalo." So he swears to him. And he sells his firstborn rights to Yaakov. And Yaakov gives Esav bread, and he gives him some of the lentil soup. And he eats and he drinks. Gets up, and he goes. And Esav despises the bechorah. Now, it seems like maybe he was caving to his physical drives and he's just overwhelmed, and that's why he was making this sale. But if I'm overwhelmed with some sort of exhaustion or physicality, and I, let's say I'm on a diet, and I just cave and I eat that donut, then when I'm done with the donut, I think, "Oh, I wish I didn't do that stupid donut. I wish I didn't eat that." But look, Esav, he fulfilled his physical need. He ate, he drank. But then when he gets up and he goes, it doesn't say he hates the lentil soup that he just stumbled for. It says he despised the bechorah. He's like, who needed that? Good riddance. So it's very mysterious, this whole episode. Okay. Now, for a little bit of insight into Esav, we're going to look at that tiny phrase that Chazal sort of hone in on, and they say right there at that word, Mina said he comes from the field, Vehu Ayif, and Esav was so exhausted. They say those words, that's actually a tiny little hint. With those words, that's where it's hinting to us that Esav, he went off the deep end. He became completely the archetype of evil. He became Esav HaRasha. That's when he was murdering and doing every kind of possible evil. Okay, so if you feel like looking at source number 3, it says he comes min hasadeh v'hu ayif. V'hu ayif, he was tired. Why was he so tired? Shaharag at the nefesh. He killed someone. Hichmadat amar, right? This is very similar to in Yirmiyahu. Ki aifa nafshi lahargim. In Yirmiyahu, it says, "Oh, my soul is so exhausted from all the killing." So just like we have killing and exhaustion correlated over there, so too over here, when it says that Esav is exhausted, it means, of course, he just murdered. So he had a long day at work murdering. That's why he's so tired, and that's why he needs the nizid anashim, adashim, right? He's super tired today. And what's interesting is the word that Chazal really, really point to over here and figure out, oh, we see from this word he's so evil, this exhaustion that shows he is sheer evil, is actually very different from the word that Chazal point to when they highlight his uncle Yishmael's evil. So one generation earlier with Yitzchak versus Yishmael, we had also two brothers. One was the archetype of good and the other the archetype of evil. But he was a very different archetype than Esav, because if you look at Yishmael, the wording is completely different. If you look in source number two, V'tera Sara et ben Hagar ha-mitzvot asher yalta la'Avram mitzachik. Sarah sees the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham, and she sees that boy Ishmael mitzachik. She sees him playing around, and she says to Abraham, drive out that maidservant and her son, because he's not, that the son of that maidservant is not going to inherit with my kid. Why not? Because she saw him playing around. So Chazal explain, look into Bereishit Rabbah. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yosef, Rabbi Yossi Aglili, Omer, Ein Halashon Hazeh Tzchok, Ela Lashon Shfichut Damim. Right, this Lashon of Tzchok, of playing around, is nothing but, if you get down to it, it really just means it's murder. He was murdering someone. Hichmadat Amar, Yakumuna Haner Arim V'Yisachaku Lefaneinu. Just like when Avner in Sefer Shmuel, when Avner said to Yoav, why don't some of our soldiers get up and play fight for us? Well, guess what? Their play fighting turned out to be, they grabbed each other by the head and stabbed each other in the fifth rib, murdering each other instantly. So just like the playing over there turned out to be murder, so too, say Chazal, the playing over here with Yishmael is murder. So we say, Yishmael, how do we know he's the archetype of evil? Well, we see he was playing. He was murdering. But then with Esav, it's not that we see he was playing. It's his murder is exhausting. The same murdering that is so pleasant and refreshing and enjoyable to Yishmael, one archetype of evil, to Esav, oh my gosh, is that murder draining. He doesn't feel good about it. That wasn't fun. That's exhausting. Why is it so exhausting? What's so tiring for Esav about all the murder and evil that he's becoming? So it is possible that the key to why Esav is so exhausted by his evil, as opposed to feeling playful, is in the location where he is, where he becomes, according to Chazal, a murderer. So the Pasuk said that it's a Esav was coming from the field, right? Minasadeh, the Hoayef, and he was exhausted. Now, you would have thought that it was saying Esav was hunting and he was tired, but it doesn't say his action. It says where he was and he was tired, right? Care where he was. Do I really care if he was tired after hunting in the jungle, in a field, and whatever, just, you know, doing some exercise in a gym? What do I care where he was? So it actually tells us something important if you think of whom we associate a sadeh with, right? The previous generation, of course, we associate the sadeh specifically with Yitzchak, right? The one person whom Esav respects and adores and reveres the most. So if you look at source number four, the Yetze Yitzchak LaSuach Basadeh, Yitzchak goes to Suach in the field, Lifnot Erev, right, towards evening, Vayisa Enav, he lifts his eyes, Vayar Vehine Gmalim Ba'im, he looks up and whoa, there are some camels, there's Rivka, his bride-to-be. So Rashi explains, what does it mean, LaSuach? Lashon tefillah. It's a lashon of davening, like yishpoch sicho. Now you should spill out his conversation before Hashem. And Sfarno really elaborates on this a little more. Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach. He goes out to speak. He says netei min haderech. He actually veers from the road. Al da'at lishpoch sicho with ne Hashem basadeh. Right, in order to spill his speech, so to speak, before Hashem in a field. He's on the main road. And he's like, you know what? I got to daven. I want to talk to Hashem privately, but I want to go off the main road. Shaloya sikuhu over drachim. I don't want any passersby to pause me, interrupt me when I'm talking to Hashem. It's just going to be me and Hashem, right? Lonely man of faith style, me and God. I want just quiet and vastness and just nature all around me. I'm going to go to a field it's going to be me and Hashem, and I'm just going to talk to Hashem. I'm going to tell him, spill my heart out to Hashem. So a field for Yitzhak is the perfect location to just connect to Hashem. Well, Esav, when Esav goes into a field, we know what he's going for. Chazal say he's going for the worst possible reasons, but he knows in the back of his mind, oh, this is literally my father's location of connection with Hashem. This is where my father's Bechor should be talking to Hashem, should be stepping into Bechor role. So when Esav is committing his murders, it's not playful. It doesn't feel good. Because there's a little voice nagging him in the back saying, no, no, no. Remember your Yitzhak's son? Doesn't part of you want to make your father proud, your father you love so much? He doesn't feel comfortable. So he wants to sin. He wants to do his stuff, but it's exhausting. It's not full-hearted. It's not comfortable, even though he wants to be doing that, right? There's yet another interesting correlation between Yitzchak and Yishmael. If you look at Shemot Rabbah on source number 5, it says as follows: Ma'asa Yishmael kishahaya ben chamesh esrei shana. What does Yishmael do when he's 15? This source says he is 15 years old, and it says hitchil lahavi tzalam min hashuk. He starts getting idols from the marketplace. V'hayim etzachikbo. He would play around with them, and he would serve the avodah zarah kamosharam lechem, just like he sees with other people. And then, of course, that's when Sarah saw him and says, "Get rid of this kid, so he's not a bad influence." Well, the same exact age that Chazal is saying about him, 15 years old, is exactly when Chazal tells us Esav went off the derech and sold his bechora to Yaakov. This cannot be a coincidence. Chazal clearly see that it's a 15-year-old mark. There's something going on at 15. Well, clearly, there's this moment in time where these young men are trying to sort of find or forge their identity. And if you would look at source number 6, at Erik Erikson's 8 stages of psychosocial development, when he's talking about identity development, so at number 5 in the list, after you sort of pass through the stages of your early years, you get to adolescence, which he says is 15 to 18 years, and there is role confusion. And he says at this point, the teenager has to come to a sense of identity in his occupation, politics, religion, etc. So 15 is the beginning of this key point, this key stage in identity, in search for who we are. Okay, and then number 6, the next stage of development is considered young adulthood, but really surprisingly, Erik Erikson has it as 19 to 40 years. Well, think about it. When is the next episode in the Yaakov Esav divergence? The next episode is when Esav just got married at 40. He's 40 years old. So the first one we see is stage number 5, where they're sort of an adolescence and trying to define their roles. And then number 6, we have the stage of young adulthood, quote unquote, okay, which Erikson said is intimacy versus isolation. And Esav, he knows if he completely has shaken off everything that his father wanted for him in terms of his identity, then how's his father going to feel about him? He's not ready to announce to his father that I'm done with that I don't care about any of that Judaism stuff. He knows it for himself. He actually feels much better once he's shaken it off, but it doesn't mean he wants to announce it to the world. He doesn't want his father to know. So James Marsha elaborates on or takes Erik Erikson's stages to the next level, and he comes up with 4 identity statuses of psychological identity development. If you look at source number 7, the main idea is that one's sense of identity is determined largely by the choices and commitments made regarding certain personal and social traits. So he posited that the adolescent stage consists neither of identity resolution nor identity confusion, but rather the degree to which one has explored and committed to an identity in a variety of domains, right? So his theory says there's 2 distinct parts that form an adolescent's identity. There's crisis, which is a time when one's values and choices are being reevaluated, and then there's commitment. He defined a crisis as a time of upheaval where your old values or choices are being reexamined. The end outcome of a crisis leads to a commitment made to a certain role or value. And Marcia says as follows, a well-developed identity gives one a sense of one's strengths, weaknesses, and individual uniqueness. A person with less well-developed identity is not able to define his or her personal strengths and weaknesses and doesn't have a well-articulated sense of self. So Esav and Yaakov are at, first by the soup episode, they're at this stage where, okay, I'm trying to figure out whom I am. Esav is suffering from cognitive dissonance. He's torn. He knows whom he wants to be, but he also knows who he should be. He almost wishes he could want to be that other person. So he's torn constantly in two. It's not a playful thing for him. It's not fun because it's not comfortable, right? And guess what? It's really tiring. If you look at source number 9, how cognitive dissonance feel. Rabbi Gugel says like this, generally cognitive dissonance is associated with feelings of discomfort and unease. You might notice these feelings amplify if the contradictory belief is something you've placed importance on, such as those relating to your sense of self, or if there are multiple contradictory beliefs. You might feel tired. And while there are other things that it lists you might feel, this is number one. Okay, the number one thing on this list is cognitive dissonance makes you feel tired. Well, that's exactly how Esav feels. He comes out of the field where he knows his father goes to daven, and his field he knows he is using to murder people, and he is exhausted. He is so torn. He knows who he wants to be, but he's not comfortable in his own skin. He doesn't know what to do. Well, he comes into Yaakov that day after he has fully stepped out as a murderer. And Yaakov sees that he's exhausted and he knows his brother. He sees what kind of exhaustion that is. He knows what his brother is feeling. He knows about his own feelings and he understands his brother's feelings. And he's like, listen, brother, you're exhausted. I think you should sell me your Bechorah. You're going to feel a lot better. I think you should just say it loud and proud, say it loud and clear who you are. You know who you are. You might as well embrace it. Stop trying to pretend. Say who you are. Just sell it to me. And Esav says, you know what? Okay. I want physicality. I don't want spirituality. It's yours. I'm going to sell it. I'm going to buy the red stuff, the Edom stuff. I'm going to sell you the Bechorah stuff. You take leadership of Bnei Israel. You take spirituality. And he feels so much better. He despises the Bechorah. He's so glad to have it off his shoulders. But just because he's glad that it's off his shoulders doesn't mean that he's ready to come out to other people as having this identity yet. He's in this middle state. There's been one crisis and one sort of form of crystallization in terms of what he wants, but he doesn't necessarily want other people to see him only that way, right? So it's going to be 25 years and he still hasn't told his father who he is, right? So meantime, let's look at Yaakov. Yaakov, this whole time, has been this big question mark. Remember, when he was born as a baby, we didn't really get insight into him. We understand he's going to want more. He's going to be a doer. He's going to be a goer. He's going to be moving towards something with goals, but we don't know what it is he wants. Now, he might be limited. Mr. Yoshev Ohalim, the one who's dwelling in the tent, he might actually be limited even just by birth order or family placement, because often we have someone who's born second or third or whatever it is, and they're defined almost by default. So for example, we have Moshe Rabbeinu who says to Hashem, Hashem is trying to send him on a mission to speak to Paro and save Bnei Israel. And Moshe says, Vayomer, be Hashem, shalach na bia tishlach, Hashem, please send the one you usually send. And Chazal explained, send Aaron. That's Aaron's thing. If it's his thing, then it's not my thing. It's his thing. I don't want to take his thing. That's him. Right. If you look at Cain and Hevel, Cain is a farmer. Hevel's a shepherd, but we don't really know if he's a shepherd because he likes shepherding or because farming was taken. Right. If farming's already taken, then I guess I'm the shepherd. Right. So Moshe and Hevel might just be a response to, well, what's left? I guess I'm identified by my family by what's left. So Yaakov is like, if Esav's in the field, maybe by default, I'm the learner in the tent. maybe that's my role. If that guy's the outgoing guy, maybe I'm the intellectual. We're all trying to seek an identity and often trying to stand out. So sometimes we will create our identities in response to somebody else, sometimes because we are perceived by that way by others, and sometimes even just because we can't be the same as them, right? We have to find ourselves some unique spot. So it's very tricky figuring out our own identity. So Yaakov has this sort of space where he feels comfortable, and now he has taken Esav's spot, at least in theory. He has bought Esav's firstborn rights. He has bought the right to be the Bechor, the leader of Bnei Yisrael. And he knows he could do it. He understands that I'm in the tent, but that doesn't mean I only can function in the tent. That's just where I kind of was always put. So I think I could really do all the things Esav does also. But his father doesn't know that, and he doesn't quite feel comfortable telling his father about it for 25 years till he's 40. So these years pass, and sometimes you see, for example, people who send their kids away to Israel, and their kids have a complete transition in their identity. They come back a totally different person. Well, they might have had some of the same drives or she'ifot when they were back in America, but they had their parents there and their siblings there and their friends there and their communities. And everyone would say, what? You don't talk like that. You don't dress like that. You don't think like, you don't believe that. You don't learn like that. You like to learn or whatever it is. So sometimes they have to wait till they're completely separated from everyone who has these sort of prior judgments of them before they can redefine themselves. So it's tricky, the balance between defining ourselves and announcing to other people, this is who I am. It's not always the same stage. So we have one stage first by the soup story at 15, and then the next stage at 40. And even then, Yaakov's hesitant. He's nervous. Rivka has to give him a push. She says, yes, I'm telling you, this bracha is for you. You could step up and be Esav. Go do it. Take it. And he does. And he allows himself to be pushed because to him, he knows this is the moment. This is going to be critical in my development because Yaakov, of all people, sees brachos as being identification. If you look at Yaakov's brachos that he gives to his sons, right, on his deathbed, Yaakov himself doesn't give a bracha like I would have given a bracha. I would think that I would tell the Shvatim, my sons, I would say, you should have atzlacha and bracha and health and shalom bayis and kids who are matzliach and Torah and everything and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You should, right? Everything. You want to throw at them everything. And look what Yaakov says to his sons. Let's get a little taster here. He says, Reuven b'choriata, kochi v'reshit oni yeser se'etz v'yeser oz. He says, Reuven, you're my firstborn. You're the first of my strength, et cetera, et cetera. He says, Shimon and Levi, you guys, your brothers, like they don't know, right? Your brothers. And he says, you guys, your anger, you have tools of anger, right? You better be careful, right? So he's not saying, this is what I want for you. He's saying, this is who you are. He defines them in the brachos, and that to him is the greatest bracha. A bracha equals, according to Yaakov, identification, definition. If you know who you are, you know what your tools are, that's the greatest bracha. Well, Yaakov realizes, oh my goodness, I've waited till I'm 40, but Abba's about to identify us. He's going to stamp me right now, or Esav right now. I better get the right stamp. I better go get the right stamp. So he rushes in there and he claims that bracha. He proves himself that I could pull an Esav. I could be sneaky and tough and I could get that bracha. I could do what he could do. I could be him. I'm telling you, I could be leader of Bnei Israel. I could be him. And he takes the bracha and Yitzchak says, oh, wow. Gam baruch yeh. Yes. He earned that bracha. That's how he identified. That's him. Now I see it. Yaakov could be that guy. Okay. Well, Yaakov has now gone from 15-year-old where he bought it to 40-year-old where now he's willing to wear it loud and proud. But is he going to make it work? Is he going to take it to the next stage? Well, he does. He runs. Yes, he runs away to save his life. And yes, he runs away to get married to find a call. But look what he's doing. He's actually putting his new life into practice. He goes And his journey is actually the field of practice where he is going to start to learn to act as an Esav, as a leader out in the world, tough and getting his hands dirty, dealing with all kinds of low lives and trickery and craziness. He's got a mentor. He's got the trickiest mentor out there, Lavan, to see, can you be an Esav? Let's see when you go up against a Lavan. And he does it. And then he crystallizes it just in case you think maybe he's going to go back and forth. No. He marries it. He marries two sides. He marries Rachel, who's Yaakov's Basheret. And then he marries Leah, who was Esav's original Basheret. And he doesn't divorce Leah when he's tricked into it because he realizes, oh, wait, she is actually the Basheret of that new part of me that I adopted, right? She's a fit. I need to be married to her too. So he has solidified himself permanently into both of his roles. It's not a double life. It's a dual life. He's being him and he's being Esav, everything that Esav could have been. And he goes through life like this. And very critically, at the end of his life, while he gives his sons brachos that define them, there's one bracha, which is the exception that proves an interesting rule. He says, when it comes to blessing his grandsons, Ephraim and Menashe, what does he do? He swaps his hands. Vayishach Yisrael esimino vayeshet al rosh Ephraim v'hu atzair. He puts his right hand on the head of Ephraim, even though he's the younger brother, v'esmolo al rosh Menashe. Sikelet yadav, he twisted his hands. Ki Menashe habachor, because wait a minute, Menashe is the elder, the firstborn. So this tells us that while yes, Yaakov holds that a bracha is supposed to be identification, he is also the first Av to say, I'm identifying you, but I acknowledge that you have a role in creating your identity and defining yourself. He's saying, Ephraim, you were not born as the leader of the brothers, but you grew into it. You learned all that Torah. You made yourself into the leader of the two of you. You deserve this bracha. So I am identifying you, but I am allowing you part in this process of saying who you are, defining yourself. And what about Esav? So we see Yaakov has actually, once he grew from stage to stage to crystallize who he is and identify himself, he has embraced this fully. He has acknowledged, I have part in saying who I am and self-defining. But what about Esav? Does Esav really fully deal with his cognitive dissonance? So by the time he gets to middle age, we want to know, has Esav fully moved on and become clear in his identity? So we see that Esav is still holding on to his resentment. When it comes to the sale of the bracha, he doesn't want Yitzhak to know that he let his bechora go. He doesn't want Yitzchak to know that I'm done with this Jewish leader stuff. It's not comfortable. It's one thing for him to let it go. It's another thing to have the whole world know about it. So he's not super comfortable about it by the time he gets to 40, even though it's a little bit mentally healthier for him. So he's holding on to this resentment even all those years later when Yaakov returns and he wants to kill him. Of course, we know Yaakov goes through the whole process of winning Esav over, and he sends him the gifts and he shows him I'm not a threat. And what does Esav say at the end of it? He says, "Vayomer, Yisavin elcha ve'elcha lenevdecha." Okay, let's travel. I'm going to travel with you. Let's go. Let's go together, twinsies. Right? We're going to go together. It's going to be great. Like old times, good old times. We're twins again. It's just like the two of us. Like back when we were kids. And Yaakov's like, no. Have you not learned anything over the years? Our paths diverged. Remember, that's what Rivka was told. That's what was clear from day one. That's what was clear through all of these stories. We were very different. We chose different paths. We are not meant to travel together. He uses the excuse, I have these little kids, I got to travel slowly. But he's really saying, look at everything I've built. My life doesn't align with yours, Esav. It doesn't make sense for us to travel together. So Esav says, okay, Yaakov has redirected him, said, we are not together. He's reminding him of who he is and who he's not. And sure enough, so Esav returns to Seir, to his home and his identity, because once again, Yaakov has set him on the straight path, reminding him again, you're you, Esav. It's okay, you're you. And at the very end of his life, the very last episode of Esav's life, we see he still hasn't gotten it. He still has not come into a healthy place in terms of his self-identity. When it comes to Yaakov's burial, Yaakov's not even alive anymore. And Yaakov's sons, the Shvatim, have brought Yaakov's body to be buried in the Maaseh Machpelah. And the Gemara, Maseches Sota, Yud Gimel Amud Aleph, says like this. It says, when they get to the Maaseh Machpelah, Esav jumps in front of it and says, no, you can't put my brother in here. This is mine. Our parents left two spots. One of them could be Yaakov's, but the other is his mine. And guess what? Yaakov already used one of them. He put Leah there. Your mom, Leah's buried in there. So there's one spot left. That's for me. Asa still thinks twinsies, right? We're going to be in there together. It's still me. I'm still the original Asa. He doesn't fully ever embrace that he has moved on. So by the way, what would this make it? This would make it that he is buried there with Leah, his original soulmate, like it was supposed to originally be. So Esav still has a habamina that, oh, I sold in the Bechora, but not this, not my eternity. But it doesn't work that way, right? And the sons say, when you sold him the firstborn rights, this is part of it. That comes with it, right? This is all part. You sold the life. You sold this world. You sold the world to come. You chose to be done with this, Esav. And of course, the Gemara proceeds to talk about how Hoshem ben Dan whacks him on the head, and his head or eyeballs, depending on the version you're looking at, rolls off and rolls into the Maaseh Machpelah, which is, of course, exactly fitting, since his head the whole time is saying almost your body, all your physicality has your whole life been going to Seir, but really your head the whole time really just wanted to be in, to be the Esav that your father wanted. Right? That is the part of Esav that told him, oh my gosh, look at that. I really want it in that, which is why he was torn from the very beginning.